This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. In Finland, so far from the house with the white picket fence near the banks of the Willamette River in Oregon, where he went to live with his aunt and his uncle when he was 9 because both his parents had died. And so far from Stanford, where he went to school, where he came into his own, where he came out of the sadness of his childhood, and began to become the man he became. Self-made, he was proud to say, with American grit and drive and vision. But in Finland, so far from the Rockies and the Sierras, in Western Australia, from the dank bellies of the mineral mines where he made his fortune, his name became a verb. Herbert Hoover was working in London when the First World War broke out. He had found his calling first in extracting value from veins of ore that everyone else had written off, and then in administration and all the big picture stuff, in financing projects and land management and permitting and purchasing, and all the mountain moving you had to do before the mining companies could move into the mountains and start making money. And London was where the banks were, so that's where Herbert Hoover was. He liked to say that if a man hadn't made his fortune by 40, he wasn't worth much. And in London, in his 30s, he had made his fortune and was a giant in his industry. And as he read the headlines in the Times of London about the war just on the other side of the channel, about the civilians in Belgium trapped between trenches, cut off from food and water and escaped by armies converging, he knew he was the man to help. He was a mover of mountains, after all. Herbert Hoover organized the first mass relief effort in the history of the world, enlisting businesses and the public. He threw dinners for wealthy donors who would spend $1,000 to eat the same meager meals as refugees did, off tin plates. He coordinated food production and storage, negotiated treaties that allowed trucks and boats safe passage through the front lines, and saved a nation on the brink of starvation. Herbert Hoover. His organization fed millions of people every day for years. He saved Belgium. And when the effects of the war rippled eastward and northward to Central Europe and Scandinavia, he fed people there too. And in Finland, a word emerged in his honor. A verb, to Hoover, meaning to help, in the spirit of charity and brotherly love. In the United States, Hoover was a hero, and he became the Secretary of Commerce. And when the worst flooding in American history struck the Mississippi River Valley and displaced 200,000 people, President Coolidge sent Hoover on a train and then boats up and down the swollen Mississippi, where he led the federal relief effort, the first of its kind in American history, and saved countless lives. Herbert Hoover. And if someone had done so much good, so well, and if that person had come with an all-American story, an orphan, a self-proclaimed, self-made man, a savior of the starving and the drowning, who wouldn't want that person to be president? And so in 1928, Herbert Hoover won one of the most lopsided elections in his nation's history. And then it all collapsed. Just 4 years later, with the country he led being crushed beneath the weight of the Great Depression, with nearly half its banks having failed, with nearly a quarter of its workforce out of a job, and with the destitute everywhere, in the parks, in the woods, bathing their children in brown rivers by boarded factories, sleeping in shacks of tin and plywood and cardboard they called Hoovervilles, sleeping under newspapers they called Hoover blankets, cooking rodents in roadkill they called Hoover hogs, over fires and barrels like you've seen in the movies and cartoons, but were real and were everywhere. Herbert Hoover was swept out of office in an even bigger landslide than the one that had swept him in. And there are arguments, there are whole books, there are shelves upon shelves straining beneath the weight of whole books making arguments about what Herbert Hoover did and didn't do to cause or not cause or worsen or lessen the impacts of the Great Depression. And there are biographies, so many, that guess at why, or why not, that wrestle with this man who did so much to help so many in need in Europe, who made sure the hungry were fed, who made sure the homeless were housed, then seemed constitutionally incapable of doing the same at home. A self-made man who seemed to have little sympathy for those who couldn't pull off the same trick, for men who hadn't made their fortunes by 40, or families who'd lost everything, who had nothing. A man who, when his staff suggested that he should cut down on the lavish dinners served each night at the White House, as there were men selling apples on street corners just outside, just to scrape together pennies to buy some bread for their kids, decided that it would be bad for the country's morale to see its president cutting corners. So each night he wore a tuxedo to dinner and sat down for 7 courses in the White House he never left. There are symposia, still, in white papers and think tank publications that invoke Hoover's name as they stake new positions in old debates about the role of the federal government in direct relief, in economic policy and public versus private spending and growth and lending, and it's exhausting. And in all those debates, it is all too easy to lose sight of the fact that the choices he made and the way that he lived his life during one part of that life led people half a world away to turn his name into a verb, because there wasn't precedent in their language for the kind of good they had seen in him. And then, in another time, through other choices, but the same life, people made his name into an adjective. And so there was a night as he left the White House, after that defeat he couldn't have imagined just 2 or 3 years before, in a private car on a train headed west, when he looked out onto the landscape and the fires in the hillsides, in stands of trees by the water, from people living in the shanty towns that bore his name. The Memory Palace is written and produced by me, Nate DeMayo, with engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. I recently gotten the chance to hang out and do some events with some of the other Radiotopia shows. Hadn't done it in a little while. And folks from the crew behind the scenes. So with Helen from The Illusionist and her brother Andy, who does the bugle, and his producer Chris, who's rad and I never met before. With Benjamin Walker, my old friend from Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything. With Lauren and Phoebe from Criminal in London and then Dublin. And then with Nigel, the co-creator and producer of the extraordinary Ear Hustle, last weekend in Toronto. And I don't really have a point here. I just want to say that I could not be more psyched that these people doing work like they do are my colleagues. Radiotopia gets ad-serving technology from AdZerk. Our ad music is composed and performed by J.D. Sampson. If you want to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, you can do that at The Memory Palace. And if you ever want to shoot me an email, please do. Head over to thememorypalace.us and click Contact. I'll be back with you soon, and thanks for listening.
Radiotopia.